Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, and every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and everything going on in our world, the healthiness of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, the health of our healthcare system, the health of our planetary ecology. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between all the different things that are impacting our health and well-being and that of our children, our families, and future generations. And we do a lot of activism because of that, trying to protect well-being here on Earth. Every week on Connect the Dots, we talk to different authors, advocates, experts, scientists, thought leaders, organizers, and others about the different facets of things going on that are impacting well-being on this planet. And today we have a returning guest and a returning topic. Those who are regular listeners to our show know that from approximately February of 2015 all the way up through June, every single week of this program was devoted to discussing different facets of fast-tracked trade deals. They go by different initials because there are different ones of them, TPP, TTIP, TISA, and others. And granting of the President Obama, authority to fast-track these deals without their provisions being fully known. So we're going to do an update today on where we now stand since the passage of fast-track last month. And in addition, we'll kind of see what actions and things that we can get involved with going forward. If you need further background on these treaties, and this is the first you're listening or hearing of them, please do go and catch up. We had a whole array of terrific experts in all different areas these treaties touch, including health, food, and the environment, of course, economics, human rights, economic justice, and a host of other topics during the first 6 months of the year here on Connect the Dots. Since the recent passage of Fast Track last month, we are kind of mixing back in some of the other kinds of shows that and topics that we've covered, such as GMOs, healthcare, and others, and you can also look forward to those in coming weeks, as well as continued coverage of this very important, uber-important theme. Returning with us today to talk about and update us on where we stand with these trade deals is a frequent guest to this program. I'm so delighted to have him back and be in conversation with him again. He's so well-informed on all facets of this. And that is Adam Weissman, an organizer with Trade Justice New York Metro, as well as the organization Global Justice for Animals and the Environment. And I think he single-handedly helped turn some very important votes in the Senate and the Congress through his organizing. He's been a terrific organizer, leader, and spokesperson on these issues. So welcome back to Connect the Dots, Adam Weissman.
Well, thank you so much for having me back again.
If you would, for our listeners, do an update of, what happened, when did Fast Track pass, what are the implications of that, and where are we now, and what are we looking to going forward, because I think we need an understanding. When all the world was kind of out there, first people were completely ignorant of this, then as they became more and more aware, and there was a lot of coverage of this, not in the heart of mainstream media, but everywhere else. A lot of analysis, a lot of very eminent and well-regarded people sharing the view that these treaties are not good for our country, our people, or life on Earth, or any society anywhere in the world. There were quite a lot of people sharing that view, but the call banner was TPP, and that's kind of what people finally kind of got clear about was, hey, TPP, let me figure out what this is, and this isn't so good. Since the fast track deals have passed, we now have other treaties coming into play. So let's give us an overview of where we are with the passage of fast track and what's coming up next.
Well, I think one thing that we first need to really make clear is a lot of people were very invested in the battle against fast track, really heard over and over that fast track is the key to passing these bad trade deals, that once President Obama has fast track authority, has his power to really railroad bad trade deals through Congress under special rules by which he is able to send already negotiated, already signed trade deals to Congress for a vote, and then Congress is required to vote on these agreements within 60 days in the House, 90 in the Senate, is unable to in any way amend the legislation, and is limited to 20 hours of floor debate in each House. Many people heard about this outrageous way of pushing bad trade deals, and upon learning that President Obama was able to sign this legislation, because unfortunately members of the Democratic Party in the Senate sold out their own colleagues to support this legislation, and in the Senate and similarly in the House, enough Democrats joined Republicans to pass fast track that this this legislation is now law. I think many people, upon hearing that, have perhaps had the impression that it's now a done deal, that TPP, TTIP, and TISA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and Trade and Services Agreement are now done deals. And I really do want to stress to people that, yes, this is now a harder fight. We certainly did not want Fast Track to pass. It was very important to keep it from passing. But these are certainly not done deals. There is still very much more of this fight ahead. There is very much more work to do. The Obama administration certainly wants to spin this as smooth sailing ahead. They're talking about, for example, with TTIP, the agreement with Europe, concluding negotiations by next year now that they have fast track authority. People we're talking to who are in Europe who follow the negotiations closely said that's utter nonsense. There's no way that negotiation is going to be finished within a year. Even TPP is still highly controversial in the negotiating phase. There's another round of negotiations coming up that begins on the 23rd with the lead ministers arriving on the 28th for 3 days of negotiations. And even at this late date in the negotiations, there are still about six chapters that are unresolved in the 29 chapters of TPP. These include some of the most controversial chapters, like the investment chapter, which gives corporations the right to sue government in international tribunals outside the jurisdiction of a nation's court system, where a corporation can demand unlimited sums in monetary compensation when they believe that a nation's public interest laws interfere with their capacity to collect expected future profits. This also includes the intellectual property chapter, which is being used by the pharmaceutical industry to push for expanded patent rights on drugs and to limit access to affordable generic medicines. There's talk about
Let me just interject something here there, because you've just mentioned the international tribunal, which is one of the most controversial and highly criticized aspects of these deals. From everyone from Senator Elizabeth Warren, I mean, everyone, you know, has been concerned about giving over our legal authority, having something above and beyond, you know, our nation's legal authority, which is giving these powers to corporations to sue. Now, let me just ask an incredibly, naive question, I guess. Why would any nation want to agree to such a provision?
The argument behind investor state is that investor state encourages foreign investment because it gives corporations the assurance that they will have an impartial venue to protect their protect their interests and their investments. The argument is that, well, in a corporation may otherwise be wary of investing in a country if they are concerned that, let's say, a new government might nationalize their assets, or in some other way new legislation might infringe upon their potential for profit. So the idea is that by giving corporations this assurance of an arbitration system that is not subject to the whims and biases of a national court system, that that will encourage further an increase in foreign direct investment from corporations. Now, the problem with that argument is, first of all, these arbitration panels are themselves not really trustworthy or objective. The people who arbitrate them are unelected international trade lawyers who in another week might be working for the same kind of corporations who bring these cases. There are no conflict of interest clauses. There is no appeals process. It would be a case that actually went to, let's say, the U.S. court system would be far fairer. The idea is that this has to be reciprocal, and these tribunals work on both ends, and that it gives corporations that kind of assurance to operate in countries where that don't have court systems that are well established, that have proven their fairness, that have well-defined norms. But really, we see the lie of that in the fact that this kind of investor-state dispute settlement process is being applied to TTIP as well as TPP, when really there aren't. This is not a major problem in the European court system. And people have also suggested that this whole argument, that there's an element of racism in this argument, that in so many of the cases where this investor-state is being applied. In the cases that are supposed to be the key cases where it needs to be, there's a level of that it's fairly insulting to the countries that it suggested can't have trustworthy courts, being largely global South countries. Though again, as we see, it is also being applied to TTIP, so which really suggests that there is something else at work here. That this is not just about having fair and impartial courts. But really what it is about is about expanding corporate power. It's about giving corporations a basis to bring claims that they wouldn't be able to under a nation's own domestic laws, and creating a system that leans towards favoring corporate interests. So investor state is really about corporate power. It's being pushed by corporations, and it's being pushed by governments who are responsive to the interests of corporations. Many of the countries in TPP and TTIP have forces that strongly oppose investor state. Many of the governments have expressed reluctance. The previous Australian government was very reluctant about this aspect of TPP, given that Australia has a history of being sued under these kinds of investment rules around issues like tobacco, and given that the U.S.-Australia Free Trade Agreement currently doesn't contain this kind of investor provisions. So there is certainly an argument that is used to defend investor state, but really it doesn't hold up very well, and the real agenda behind it is pretty clear when we see again and again that these investment rules have been used to advance corporate interest against the public interest, with cases like the Renko case in Peru that was brought under the U.S.-Peru Free Trade Agreement, where a corporate investor brought an $8 million suit against the Peruvian government for demanding remediation of a toxic smelter site after getting two extensions and for the third time being demanded, getting a demand to clean up what's deemed one of the 10 most toxic sites in the world. This billionaire U.S. investors company, Ira Rennert, brought this suit in a tribunal to try to escape accountability. There's a case in Canada right now where a Canadian company is using a U.S. subsidiary to claim to be a U.S. company in order to gain access to these investor rights under the North American Free Trade Agreement so that they can sue Canada because Quebec banned fracking. And this energy company, Lone Pine Resources, had an interest in fracking in Quebec and wants to really challenge this law so that they can continue to profit off of this unsustainable, unsafe, and dangerous technology and extraction method. So
let me just ask another question here, which is, you know, I think there's without a doubt, and you're really sharing the reasons why this particular provision is so heinous and so many people are troubled by it. But one thing I often hear as well is that people actually have a problem, you know, getting their minds around it. So, for example, you know, you'll cite this and they'll say something like, oh, well, you know, even once these treaties are signed and, you know, all of this has gone through, it can still be changed because, you know, the American government would not permit, you know, the courts would not permit something like that, you know, and there has to be some way that people could bring this to court or even say that our signing of these treaties is unconstitutional. You know, it can't be that, you know, once this is a done deal, there's no way of sort of taking it back. And as more and more people become aware of what these treaties involve, there'll be more and more of a demand to do that. Love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think people shouldn't be thinking about trying to retroactively erase these trade deals. We need to fight these trade deals now. There really is no history of the U.S. joining trade agreements and then thinking better of it later. We saw Obama promising as a candidate that he would use the quote-unquote hammer of an opt-out to push Mexico and Canada to the negotiating table in order to push for some reforms on NAFTA, and we saw where that went. I mean, that was just an outright lie that he used to try to lock some primaries. But I don't think I think at this point our focus really just needs to be on stopping these trade deals while we can. And we still can. It's going to be an uphill battle. It's going to be a difficult battle. I think we're going to have to wage it on many different fronts. We need to keep calling and writing to our members of Congress, but we also need to be taking to the streets. We also need to be mass mobilizing. We need to be doing more to raise the visibility of this issue. There's a lot that still needs to be done, but I think people need to be just thinking that, recognizing that now is the critical time. These next few months, which may be the last months before TPP goes to a congressional vote, this is when the work needs to be done. A lot of people, I think, have a sense that after the fast track vote, well, you know, now we have some downtime before TPP comes up again. That's not true. We need to be organizing right now. This summer is absolutely critical. Congress goes into recess for the entire month of August, and at that point, we need to be getting to all of our elected officials' events when they're doing town halls and when they're doing fundraisers and when they're doing all kinds of other events in the community, appearing at parades or whatever else. We need to be there demanding to know where they stand on TPP and how they intend to vote. It's not clear whether this is going to happen, but it's quite possible that TPP negotiations may actually conclude in this final round at the end of July. And so then the clock starts ticking. Once TPP is signed, then President Obama will initial it a month later. He can legally sign it. Once the negotiation is completed, then the agreement, which has been negotiated in secret, becomes public. Then Obama mm-hmm. can sign it. Then 2 months later, Congress can vote on it. So there will be a three-month period between when the negotiations end and when a vote can happen, which means that, let's say we're talking about, in theory, it may not happen this way, but if we're talking about TPP negotiations concluding at the end of July, then let's say August 1st is the day that TPP gets initialed, then we're talking about August to September, September to October, October to November. And so we're talking about it, and then Congress at that point has 60 days to vote in the House and 90 in the Senate, but that doesn't mean they're required to use all those days. They could very well vote on the first day. So we are potentially looking at a vote on TPP in theory as soon as November. Not necessarily the most likely scenario, but it is a real possibility. So that means that right now is a critical time for us to be doing everything possible to raise the alarm, to make it politically untenable for our elected officials to vote for this terrible trade deal. And that will really only happen if far more people know about it than already do. We need to make this issue much more public and really get across to people what the stakes are, what we stand to lose, and why we can't afford this rotten trade deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they were to sign it with the minute they get it, that basically says they have never read it and they're not going to read it, because even what was offered to them to read, you know, wasn't the complete deal, because that's still being negotiated, as you point out. So, I mean, isn't that I mean, the idea that they would instantly pass it without taking the time to read it or digest it for those who are paying attention, it would send a kind of bad message about where we really are with our democracy in terms of, whether our public officials are even, on the watch at all about any of this.
Right.
So that's
well,
a
at
horrifying
that point, they will,
prospect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, at that point, it will have been public for 3 months.
Okay.
So it won't
mm-hmm.
be a matter of, because once the negotiations conclude, then the agreement, and that, this is built into the fast-track legislation. This was the one of the little band-aids that was supposed to make this fast-track so much better than past fast-tracks, because now there's this waiting period when people can read it. It's pretty silly, though, quite frankly, because at that point, what they're basically saying is you can now read this done deal. Civil society has been locked out of the negotiating process every step of the way, while the corporate advisors to this trade agreement on the U.S. Trade Representatives Industry Trade Advisory Council have had the inside track access to actually read and comment on the negotiating texts. We, the people, and the organizations that represent us, with a minute number of exceptions, have been totally locked out. Even those civil society representatives who are on the industry, who are on advisory councils, are sworn to secrecy about what they read, so they can't actually communicate that with their base. They even have a hard time communicating with experts who can advise them on some of what they're reading. And so we're locked out until it's a done deal, and then we can read whatever terrible agreement has already been negotiated. Congress then, I mean, we don't know that, I'm not suggesting that Congress is necessarily going to vote on this the first day. What we do know, but it's in theory possible, what we do know is that Congress does have a history of moving pretty quickly on fast-track trade deals. So it's possible that maybe we'll be looking at a vote 2 weeks after it's sent to Congress. So mm-hmm. my mm-hmm. point is just that we are not, people should not misunderstanding the idea that Congress has 90 days to vote on trade agreements, 60 in the House, 30 more in the Senate, with meaning that they have to use up all those days. That first 90-day period before TPP goes to Congress, that is a mandatory 90 days. But that second 90 days, that is how long, that's their deadline to vote on it. That doesn't mean that that's not a waiting period until they can vote on it, which, again, mm-hmm. is why we're looking at this fall really as being very likely when TPP will be voted on, if they're able to conclude the negotiations in this coming negotiating round. Again, that's not a sure thing. There's a lot of ongoing controversy. Japan is now talking about potentially pushing Canada out of the negotiation, because Canada does not want to modify their agriculture supply management system, and they're concerned about protecting their poultry and dairy industries. The U.S. Mm-hmm. and Japan still have, well, at least they haven't announced that they have resolved all of their issues around agricultural tariffs. Again, as I said, the intellectual property issues around medicines are still controversial. There's some back and forth with countries like Malaysia around that issue. So there's still potentially things that may drag on beyond this Hawaii round. There's also, in order to increase the tension, there are protests being planned for the Hawaii round, lots of creative actions that are being considered. So this may extend longer, and we hope it does, because as we all know, the longer this goes on, the more opportunity there is to get the word out, and the closer we get to the 2016 election. And since every elected official who votes for these trade agreements knows very well that they are selling out the public on behalf of corporate donors when they vote for these trade agreements, they very much like them, these votes, to happen as quietly as possible. That's why you see, for example, that the Senate voted on fast track on the Friday of Memorial Day weekend. No one wants no elected official wants to let the public know that they're voting for these deals, because everyone knows what they're doing. They know that they're not representing the voters, and they're just padding their pockets, and it doesn't look very good when you do that. So they want to hide these votes. They always do.
Yeah. And yet when you see them standing up and parading on the Senate floor and making all these speeches about how great this is, it also seems like basically, they think people are dumb, not watching, don't get it, and will just kind of, believe whatever they say. If they stand up and they, salute a local, high school food, event or something like that, they think that's going to reassure the residents of their state that they're on their side as they kind of vote away our entire economy and health and the environment, you know, with these votes. So it's, you know, I mean, on the one hand, I guess, you know, with all the influx of money into politics, to some extent, if the public were organized and as the public becomes organized, they still have something to fear from the public. But it also seems like they have a very low opinion of the public, and the public is somewhat disengaged from this and doesn't really, you know, get what's, you know, some segments do and many segments don't and are really ignorant that this is even going on. So their low estimation of the public, you know, may be wrong in some cases and, you know, justified in others. Now, let's just switch gears for a moment here and talk a little bit about the European deal, because I think, you know, we have covered a little on the show. You've discussed it a bit in past programs. But what are we knowing more about the Atlantic deal, the European deal, to which, you know, you referred that wasn't so well known until recently, would you say?
Well, the biggest new development around TTIP is that the European Parliament just passed legislation. They just passed a resolution effectively giving a green light for TTIP negotiations. They said that they were asked to vote on, in effect, what they would want to see in a TTIP deal, which doesn't really mean very much because it's not particularly binding on the negotiators at the European Commission. But ultimately a majority in the European Parliament did vote, and it was quite controversial, but did ultimately vote to pass this sort of model TTIP that ultimately says that they support this negotiation. One interesting thing in there, though, was that they kind of watered down investor state a little bit. They kind of said that they are not big on the investor state system, and they replaced it with sort of an international trade court that would not have the same model of investor arbitrators outside of a court, would not be the same sort of secret arbitration, but would be more of a transparent public process. And so in practice, what is this going to mean? Well, for one thing, the U.S. is not going to accept that. The U.S. wants investor state. The U.S. likes investor state because corporations like investor state. So in practice, it's not going to mean much in terms of the actual negotiation. But it is a strong statement that Europe, even those who are willing to vote in support of having TTIP negotiations, do not support investor state. It also sends an interesting message to the TPP countries, which raises the question, if the European countries are not open to investor state, why should we be? One of the things that's going to make TTIP tricky is the actual countries in Europe are going to have to ratify TTIP. So there is real question as to, with such strong critique, even when they're expressing ultimate support for TTIP, being built in to this vote, when if TTIP ultimately comes out with investor state built into it, it raises real questions about whether the individual countries are going to be willing to vote for this thing. So TTIP may be in trouble in the long term. We're hearing that in the long term, either TTIP may not survive, or that what we may see is a very much watered down version of TTIP that was not nearly the robust agreement it was intended to be. That maybe food issues will be left out of TTIP. That many other areas that have been controversial may be removed. So that's, again, not to let anyone give anyone a sense that the fight is over and we have nothing to worry about. We have plenty to worry about. But the good news is that in Europe, far more so than here, there is an awareness of what the stakes are of this agreement, and there is mobilization. The media, Europe has a stronger, in European countries, there's stronger public media than there is here in terms of actually government-funded public media. And so people have better access to this information, in part that's because the public media has a vested interest in fighting TTIP, because they're concerned about a privatization agenda that could attack their funding. So a lot of people do realize in the European countries what is at stake here. In different countries, different issues are the strongest issue. In the UK, for example, there is concern about how TTIP could potentially be used to attack their public health care system, the NHS. In much of Europe, there are concerns about Europe's higher standards on food and food protection, food safety laws, animal welfare rules, and recognizing that TTIP is one of the pretty explicit goals of big food in the U.S., of people like the National Pork Producers Council, of companies like Monsanto, is to get into Europe and use TTIP to attack food safety regulations, to attack rules limiting the cruelty of factory farms, to attack GMO labeling rules, also to attack some of Europe's higher regulatory standards on products like pesticides. The neonicotinoid pesticides that companies like Monsanto manufacture, which have been recognized as a threat to the survival of bees, are one area where people are very concerned that a deregulation under agenda under TTIP could help to bring unsafe products back to the marketplace. That,
drill into that a little bit. You're
sure.
Saying, I just want to be super clear and sure that our listeners are super clear about the mechanisms. So if TTIP passes with these provisions, or without these provisions, then it basically means that our companies can go in and start suing European companies, and this is part of the agenda, that these global corporations want to sue the European countries and take down their better laws, and they would regard the treaty as a mechanism for doing that. Is that correct, or would they put in a bureaucratic oversight system, or what are the mechanisms by which a passage of the TTIP, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the one that is involved with Europe, what would be the mechanisms that in signing that would then allow these companies to do what you're describing?
There are several. One is, as you mentioned, the investor state system, which gives corporations the power to sue governments. Another is, and this was just recently leaked in April, there were major leaks of the European Commission's proposed chapter on regulatory cooperation, which is one of these kinds of, you hear in sort of trade speak all these nice-sounding phrases and terms like partnerships and cooperations and harmonization. Every time you hear these kind of words, be afraid, because they always mean terrible things. So I'm just going to read a quick quote from Paul de Klerk of Friends of the Earth Europe. And it talks a little bit about what this regulatory cooperation proposal suggests. So he says that the Commission proposal introduces a system that puts every new environmental, health, and labor standard at risk, labor standard at European and member states at risk. It creates a labyrinth of red tape for regulators to be paid by the taxpayer that undermines their appetite to adopt legislation in the public interest. Corporate Europe Observatory says that harmonization of regulatory frameworks between the EU and the U.S., once the TTIP negotiations are done, that's his explanation of what this regulatory cooperation means. And the goal really is to ensure that regulations do not pose barriers to trade, and they'll do this through the creation of a new bureaucratic agency that would vet legislation to ensure that it would meet the standard of harmonized legislation, this sort of flattened standard between the U.S. and Europe, which is really a race to the bottom, which is really about creating the standards that are most corporate friendly and most and least public interest friendly across the board. The Center for International Environmental Law says that laws will be evaluated on whether or not they are compatible with the economic interests of major companies. Responsibility for this screening will lie with the regulatory cooperation body, a permanent, undemocratic, and unaccountable conclave of European and American technocrats. So this is basically creating bureaucracy to prevent public interest legislation. They continue, also Center for International Environmental Law. We are concerned about this new version, talking of the new text, because it would take power away from legislators and regulators and give it to this group of technocrats that is not elected and operates in secrecy. Secondly, this would burden lawmakers with extremely heavy procedures, create red tape, and force legislators at the state, local, and federal level to spend large amounts of time answering questions about regulations. So in effect, what they're saying is that this is, by design, something that will put a chilling effect on public interest regulation, that will make it more difficult and more cumbersome to pass legislation to protect consumers against dangerous product, to protect our food, to protect our environment. And overall, there's this, the agenda that's being pushed here is an assault on the precautionary principle, on the idea that we should know whether the products that are introduced into our bodies and into our environment are safe before we actually force them on consumers, rather than using all of us as a massive experiment to find out after the fact that we've all been poisoned, which is the way corporations like it, and what they call a science-based approach. We are the science that is being done. Our bodies are the science. We are the experiment, as far as the corporations are concerned.
That's right. The basic trick, and people get really confused about this. I mean, I almost feel like my sole job is kind of unraveling this particular confusion. People have been trained like little dogs to say, where is the scientific evidence? This isn't true unless there's scientific evidence. And people who are not well educated and well versed in these topics think that they are being smart, thoughtful, intellectual, and, rational when they ask this kind of question without looking into the larger question of how science is conducted, who pays for it, with what agenda, and what gaps therefore exist by, plan in our scientific knowledge. And so we've been taught to respect science and scientists, and of course I'm a science writer fundamentally, and I certainly do respect them, but not for the willful gaps that have been created in our knowledge, particularly around the areas of what the health and environmental impacts are of a lot of the scientifically derived profit-oriented technologies that have been developed and products that have been developed without really, any kind of thorough understanding of what the health impacts are. So, you're not really knowledgeable about science, and you're not standing up for science to just parrot, like, show me the study, because that's the mechanism. These, kind of narrow, contrived studies are what has been performed and paid for in order to sell us certain products and to say, this equals that equals this and it must be okay, but without a broader look and without a full spectrum look, because when those questions are raised, the answer is, well, science doesn't yet know. Well, it doesn't yet know because it didn't pay for it, it didn't study it, and it's not looking into it. And when, an independent scientific study or research comes along that reveals other corners of that, it's just fought tooth and nail, and there's this pseudo battle about what is scientific, and people really don't have the familiarity or analytic tools. So from what you're describing, this is actually shifting the conversation, so we're not even talking about whether or not corporate science has or has not demonstrated health impacts that we should take seriously. Now the argument or the criteria for discussion is even shifted from this academic pseudo-corporate science to, you know, whether it affects the profit line. So here we're even cutting out the science that is performed, because if it affects somebody's profits, that becomes the primordial value for, you know, saying thumbs down. And so instead of pushing forward with science and saying, let's expand our scientific study, let's make it more independent, let's really research the impacts of what we're looking at here and how it will affect us, we're actually saying, well, we've sold them that one because, you know, we kind of polarized them around the science. And now let's just even take that off the agenda as being a criteria. The sole agenda is whether a corporation will, you know, sustain its profits or not. And if it meets the criteria of it's harming the profits, you know, then it goes bye-bye. So it's a really, you know, a horrifying development.
And yeah, I mean, I think that's really, at the end of the day, what I think that you make a really important point, that really this is about these agreements are about a total transfer of power away from government that on at least some level have an obligation to be, at least create the illusion of being responsible to the people who actually vote for them, to just outright corporate rule, to a system of rules that are by design focused on advancing corporate interests above all else, that place corporate profits above any other priority, which, you know, it raises the question of always of where, when you're talking about things like the safety of the environment and about what planet exactly do the executives of these corporations expect that they're going to live on. But I think it also just speaks to the nature of the corporate system. They're not really in control. They're riding they're riding this train that steering these entities that have their own course, that are devoted above all to creating profit for their investors. And if these executives were not as ruthlessly as possible ensuring the advancement of their corporation's profits above all else, they would soon be expected to find new jobs, even when advancing those profits as individuals hurts their own personal interests and the interests of the people they care about. So we're letting the most dangerous and out of control element of our society and of our world, the multinational corporation, take more power. We're putting this most reckless and out of control element in charge of our laws, of our regulatory policy, and they already have too much control as it is, and the effects have already been disastrous. But what these agreements will do is make a bad thing even worse.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Exactly. So what are we're kind of coming down to the last 15 minutes or so of the show. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, what people can do. First thing, everybody can go to www.citizens.org/trade/. And this is the site of Public Citizen, which has been a leader in bringing this information forward, lobbying about it. If you're not familiar with this, you can check out a bunch of videos and blogs and other information they have. FlushTheTPP.org is another site where you can go and look for actions and also sign up on Facebook pages. What do you recommend, Adam, that people do to stay informed?
Well, people can also check out our website at TradeJustice.net for Trade Justice New York Metro, and for Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, people can go to GJAE.org. We also have groups and pages on Facebook and Twitter accounts, and people can find those through our websites. Another great way for people to stay plugged in is tomorrow evening is tonight, not tomorrow evening, is the National TPP Resistance Call, which is sponsored by PopularResistance.org, the people who run the National TPP, run the Flush the TPP website. People can find info on that call by going to flushthetpp.org, and then if you click on the news link there, you'll find information about the call right there at flushthetpp.org. People can also go to our Facebook group to find that information. If you go to tradejustice.net/FBG, that's a short link to our Facebook group, and so you'll find the information on that call. I'm going to be also tomorrow on the Revolution Radio's program Event Horizons at 10 a.m. if people want to hear more. And that's you can find that at freedomslips.com and then click on Studio A. And, of course, people can listen to the archives of this program for many for interviews that we've done together and many of the other great guests that you've had on this topic. One issue that I think people really need to be paying attention to right at this moment and something that gives us a critical opportunity for action is the issue around Malaysia and human trafficking and TPP.
So let's discuss in order that. Very important, yeah.
Yeah, it's just speaking to just how utterly ruthless the Obama administration is about pushing these agreements. There's perhaps no better example than this one. So Senator Menendez, with concern about the egregious human rights issues in Malaysia concerning human trafficking, passed an amendment, pushed an amendment that was successfully became part of the fast-track legislation in the Senate that would prevent Fast Track from being applied to a trade agreement that included any country that was on the Tier 3 list of human trafficking nations as decided by the State Department. Essentially, these are the worst of the worst nations regarding failing to address the crisis of human trafficking. This became even more of an urgent matter at the end of May when human trafficking camps and mass graves were uncovered in Malaysia, and these are largely trafficked persons from Burma. These are from the Rohingya Muslim population from Burma. Human trafficking is a major ongoing crisis in Malaysia. People are trafficked into industries like the palm oil trade, which is itself an environmental disaster. And so there was real concern about entering a trade agreement that could actually help to exacerbate the problem of human trafficking. So the Menendez Amendment did make it into the final fast-track bill, an attempt to water it down by Menendez himself, unfortunately, along with the infamous Senator Ron Wyden, the major Senate pusher of fast-track on the Democratic side, actually failed because the amendment process on the final bill was cut short before that weakened amendment could be added. So in order to address this, to prevent this human rights defense from being built into Fast Track, President Obama colluded with to build in into a separate bill, the Customs Enforcement Bill, an amendment that would water down the Fast Track amendment in the human trafficking amendment in the Fast Track bill would sort of retroactively change that legislation. So now there are two things that are happening that we need to pay attention to. One is that amendment is not in the House, in the Senate version of the Customs Enforcement Bill, this amendment that would water down the human trafficking language. And so that bill is going to go into a conference committee, and it is very important for us to put pressure on all of the members of that conference committee to keep out that amendment, to stand up for human rights and to oppose human trafficking, and to say that we do not want Fast Track applied to trade agreements with countries that have not addressed this terrible human rights problem. For my fellow people in the New York metropolitan area, Chuck Schumer is one of the people who is on that committee. He needs to hear from us. Senator Menendez is now actually trying to push against that amendment and is also very concerned about something truly outrageous and cynical that the Obama administration is doing. Apparently, as one strategy to circumvent this human trafficking amendment, the State Department has delayed release of their human trafficking report, and there's a leak to Reuters suggesting that the reason is that they intend to move Malaysia from Tier 3 down to Tier 2, which would void this amendment being applied to Malaysia and thus ultimately to TPP. Now, human rights groups are saying there is zero substantive reason for that move, particularly with this latest discovery of trafficking camps and mass graves. There's no evidence that Malaysia has taken the necessary steps to address this issue, and the only possible reason this is being discussed is as a strategy for the Obama administration to make an end run around that amendment and basically sell out human rights and show that it is willing to support slavery in order to pass TPP.
Wow.
And so we now must raise this issue, must put pressure on Secretary Kerry and let him know that the world is watching and that we will not accept this upgrading of Malaysia, put pressure on the members of this conference committee, let our other elected officials know that we want them to put pressure on the conference committee members. There have been two letters that have been generated, one from the Senate, members of the Senate, and one from members of the House, to Secretary Kerry expressing concern about this upgrading. In the House letter, which is a bipartisan letter, was signed by 160 members of the House. So this is an issue that is drawing attention, and it is one of the most important things that we can do right now. First of all, to tangle up TPP and Fast Track. Secondly, to expose how these trade agreements are pushing an agenda that really puts human rights on the sidelines. One of many examples, we're also looking at a trade agreement that will prohibit states from using selective purchasing as a policy tool to put pressure on countries like Brunei and Malaysia around the human rights violations connected to their use of anti-gay, anti-women, anti-Christian Sharia law. And so the same.
So in other words, we don't have a chance. This basically the whole concept of, you know, people voting with their dollars. This means that people won't have any right to choose who they support or who they won't. It takes that right away, among other things. If for those who have dollars, you know, to choose things with, that's outrageous, isn't it?
Right. In terms of not in terms of individual purchasing, government purchasing. And but the history there, that kind of campaign of using government purchasing, of basically saying that our, for example, our state will refuse to do business with any company that is doing business in this country, that was a very important tool that was used to challenge apartheid in South Africa. That kind of economic pressure was critical to bring to bringing down apartheid. South Africa was economically backed into a corner. It wasn't just that all of a sudden one day South Africa woke up and decided that racism was a bad idea. There was an international campaign, and this was one of the key tactics that was used. And there's a very clear eye in this trade agreement to preventing that kind of human rights activism. There's an amendment that was specifically added to Fast Track that would discourage the U.S. from having, that would try to use, encourage the U.S. to use trade agreements to discourage companies, countries from boycott, divestment, and sanctions policies targeting human rights abuses by Israel. So this is very explicitly, and that was obviously pushed on behalf of the Israel lobby by Senator Cardin of Maryland, among others, and Ron Wyden was a big supporter. So there is a real explicit attack on human rights built into these trade deals and into Fast Track. And an attack on
really
the tools that we
use
to advance human rights.
So this is changing, you know, the playing field in so many different ways. And one of the things about things that change the playing field, I mean, from one of my very, in fact, I think my first article on this topic in Alternet, and, you know, any readers can Google my name, Allison Rose Levy, and Alternet in order, and as well as Truthdig, where I've covered this topic, was kind of saying that it was like the next phase of Citizens United. And in fact, I really happen to believe that, because it was, you know, everyone's saying the treaties have been negotiated by multinational corporations in private for 5 years. 5 years ago is when they got Citizen United. So, you know, it's hard to believe that companies, which are very much about strategy, don't have a strategic plan while we're there kind of reacting to each new thing, hoping for the best kind of thing. One of the things that's really hard for people to imagine, and Citizens United is a perfect example of it, is how these kinds of global systemic changes change the whole playing field. So we're reasoning based on the playing field that we have known up till now. And we're saying, well, this couldn't happen or that couldn't happen or it sounds minor to me, based upon the playing field that we've enjoyed and become accustomed to. So every single thing that we're discussing here today, Adam, and that we discuss on every one of the programs that you do, the organizing you do, the programs that I've covered, the articles I've written, every single thing that we're doing is really, you know, it may sound boring or you know, kind of, oh, this couldn't possibly be happening, you know, or we need trade, is sketching out the far-reaching consequences of things that are going to change the playing field. And the thing is that once the playing field is changed, as we've seen with Citizen United, it's extremely hard to dial it back. And it's also very hard to even imagine and project all the multiple consequences of this kind of systemic change. So, you know, that's what this is for. I urge people not only to follow the leads that we suggested and staying in touch with this issue, but also inform other people about it. Have those conversations, those wake-up call conversations with people you know. Now is the time to do it. Say, do you know about the trade deals? It's not over yet. Are you aware? Are you informed? Inform other people. We need more people informed and involved, engaged in taking action. So I just want to thank you so much, Adam Weissman, of Trade Justice New York Metro and Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, for your amazing, amazing work on all of these fronts and your determination, the energy, the smarts that you have spent teaching people and yourself investigating all these treaties. You know, one more thing that I'd like to say is, you know, the other side, I mean, there's been announcements in the press recently that all of the major officials that are, you know, supposedly in our employ representing us in government, such as Michael Froman, the U.S. Trade Representative, and others working for him, they're supposedly, you know, working on our behalf. They've, in fact, been paid millions of dollars. Millions, really, each of them, to the tune of millions of dollars by these major banks and other companies that are vested in the outcome of these agreements and in pushing forward their agenda. On our side of the spectrum, and they have a long-term strategy, I believe. So, you know, I think it's naive to think that they wouldn't. That's what a business plan is. That's what they have, you know, huge amounts of people figuring all this stuff out while we're, you know, kind of raising the alarm with the public. So I want to appeal to anyone who's listening to this show, if you or anyone you know has a company, has a business in any of the healthy areas we're touching, I think the best thing that anyone could possibly do would be to donate to WikiLeaks. By virtue of WikiLeaks, we know what the provisions are. Donate to them. You know, I've donated to them. For $75,000, they'll find out what these treaties are. We'll be able to pour through the provisions. Granted, you know, we may be knowing them soon, but some of them may be a work in progress. You know, they will find the whistleblowers who will reveal the documentation. There are a lot of people very disaffected with this direction in our world. So, you know, it's time to stand up and sort of put your money where your mouth is and, you know, do the right thing. And I just, you know, thank you so much, Adam Weissman. I'm sure you'll be back again on the show as this continues. Thank you, listeners, for being with us on Connect the Dots again this week. Please join me again next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well, everyone. Have a healthy, happy, and engaged week. It was dark and it was light.